You're listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Everyone do sit down, please. Now we need Charlena. Where'd she go? There she is. Here. All right. Thank you. Welcome to our last panel of the afternoon, and I'm sure not the most boring. Georgia never bores anybody. My name is Ken Yalowitz. I'm the director of the Dickey Center for International Understanding at Dartmouth College, and delighted to welcome you to this panel. I wanted to say just a few words before introducing the wonderful panel that Tom Duvall has gathered to speak about Georgia. When I arrived as ambassador to Georgia too many years ago, 13 years ago now, one of the first people that I went to see was Alex Rondelli, whom many of you know, the chairman of the Georgian Foundation for Strategic and International Studies. And he proceeded to tell me in the course of an hour and a half all the things that were wrong with Georgia, how hopeless the situation was, how bad everything was. And at the very end, he shrugged his shoulders and he says, "Don't worry, Georgia will always survive. Everything is going to be fine." And I've often thought about that because when I think about Georgia, you know, over these 20 years, that's really not a bad way to look at things. And when you look at the remarkable things that have happened in Georgia, you know, over these 20 years, the civil war, the two separatist conflicts, a period of brief stability, 1995 to 98, then the Russian financial crisis, the assassination attempts against Shevardnadze, all the things that eventually led to increases in corruption, a variety of other problems, and leading to a lot of people calling Georgia a failed state. Then came 2003, the Rose Revolution, another period of uplift, followed by the demonstration that was rather brutally broken up in November of 2007, the war with Russia, and then the three-year period today. So Georgia clearly has survived, and it's more than survived, but how has it survived? And that's the question that we're going to be looking at today. What have been the results of 20 years of democracy building, of state consolidation, of development of the rule of law, civil society, and certainly the role of the media? And we're really blessed today to have three just wonderful, wonderful presenters who come from different facets of Georgian society, political, if you will, academic, and the media. And I'd like to turn the floor over to them right now. The ground rules are that we have only three, so each speaker will have about 15 minutes, and then we'll move to questions and answers afterward, and we should have, you know, till about 5:45. So the first speaker is Ivelian Khaindrava, who's the director of the South Caucasus Studies Program at the Republican Institute in Georgia. He was a member of parliament and also a member of the State Constitutional Commission. The second speaker is Gia Nodia, who's a professor of politics and the director of the International School of Caucasus Studies in Ilya Chavchavadze State University in Tbilisi. And finally, Sharina Shavardashvili, who's a co-partner and publisher at an independent media house since 2004 in Tbilisi. And Ivelian, please lead us off.
Thank you, Ambassador. I am in dual capacity here because as far as my luggage is still on its way from Munich to Washington, what you see, I am wearing Tom's clothes. What is inside, this is me, Ivelian Khaindrava. So whatever you like in my presentation is mine. Whatever you don't, it's Tom's. I think that two decades after the collapse of the Soviet Union in Georgia, I mean, maybe divided into three main stages. The years 1994, which include Gamsakhurdia's short rule and post-Gamsakhurdia and early Shevardnadze periods, from my point of view, this stage may be defined as independence and chaos. The years 1995-2003, Shevardnadze's period, which I would define as stability and stagnation. In the years 2004-2011, Saakashvili's period, describing which I would apply to Gia Nodia's definition of authoritarian modernization, putting question mark in the end because his period is not over so far and it is still unclear what will overweight finally, modernization or authoritarianism. Gamsakhurdia's period, well, we may argue that it started on April 9, 89, but official starting point was October 1990 elections, a year before formal disintegration of the Soviet Union, and these were multi-party elections which resulted in peaceful removal of communists from power, and this may be regarded as a success per se. Then the referendum was held on March 31st of 1991, and it proved vast support to the idea of independence, and declaration of independence followed on April the 9th. Some other positive events of that period may be mentioned here as well. First, municipal elections, rather fair, by the way. An interesting deal with Abkhaz regarding representation in the Supreme Council of the Autonomous Republic, based actually on the ethnic quota, which we don't like probably, but it was an interesting step in the direction of cooperation. The law on citizenship, which was quite liberal law, contrary to some similar laws on the territory of the former Soviet Union. But altogether, the years 99, from 1990 to 94 are noteworthy for constitutional mess because the Soviet constitution was amended every next days. Wars in Abkhazia and South Ossetia, and Ken mentioned this. Intra-Georgian civil conflict, lawlessness and uncontrolled military paramilitary groups, economic and infrastructural failure, hyperinflation, military coup, attempted presidential assassination. To put it brief, it was chaos. And depiction of this period may rather be left to psychologists or even psychiatrists than to political scientists. The first phase of Shevardnadze's period, 95 to 98 probably, was marked with real progress on the way of setting benchmarks of independent statehood. In the domestic affairs, the following achievements may be mentioned. Neutralization of paramilitary units that were the main source of chaos and insecurity in the country. Adoption of constitution in 95, maybe not excellent at all, but quite democratic on the paper at least. Introduction of national currency, which is still alive and quite stable, by the way. Establishment of democratic institutions such as Constitutional Court and Ombudsman's Office. Parliament of Georgia, intellectually dominated by the group of young reformers under leadership of Zhuani and Saakashvili, passed a portion of liberal laws. NGOs and independent media, whether printed or electronic, were booming, as well as freedom of expression, and I hope my colleague will cover this issue. In foreign affairs, Western vector appeared and strengthened in Georgia, in Georgian foreign policy, after Shevardnadze realized that Russia was not a partner in a restoration of territorial integrity and not a partner at all. Georgia started participation in NATO programs such as IPAP and others. Georgia was the first among South Caucasus states to become a member of Council of Europe. Baku-Tbilisi-Ceyhan oil pipeline and Baku-Tbilisi-Erzurum gas pipeline projects, politically even more significant for Georgia than economically, were agreed upon and launched. In 1999, agreement on withdrawal of Russian military bases from Georgia was achieved in Istanbul. Train and equip American military program resulted in solution of Pankisi Gorge problem. Finally, Shevardnadze officially declared Georgia's intention to join NATO at the NATO Prague summit in 2002. Mainly, although not exceptionally, these are achievements of the mid-90s. 98 may be considered as a kind of watershed, when much-awaited resignation of the cabinet turned into minor reshuffle of the government and produced huge frustration, actually. Executive branch effectively blocked implementation of reformist laws. Lack of political will and ability of Shevardnadze to reform the country in depth became obvious. This was political fatigue, or rather exhaustion, on the background of institutional weakness. Life in Georgia in the second phase of Shevardnadze's period, 1999-2003, may be depicted in just two words, stagnation and corruption. It was not just shadow economy, but the state itself became a kind of shadow state. His last 5 years occurred to be wasted time and lost opportunities for Georgia, and served only to accumulation of revolutionary potential in society. Saakashvili's period, especially first year, I mean 2004-2007, significant successes were achieved in various spheres, such as peaceful reintegration of Adjara in the country's common political and economic space, reform of public service and bureaucracy, including patrol police, elimination of petty corruption, curbing theft and street crime, considerable improvement of infrastructure, multiple increase of budgetary revenues as a result of improved fiscal efficiency. At the same time, these achievements from the very beginning were mixed with supercentralization of power, establishing of arbitrary decision-making process, adventure in Tskhinvali in summer of 2004, shrinking democratic space, subordinating judiciary to executive, monopolization of TV media, sidelining and even marginalizing political opposition, and consolidation of party and a half political system. Still, Saakashvili's achievements obviously eclipsed his failures, especially for foreigners. The first alarm that was noticed by some in the West came in November 2007 after cruel crackdown on street protesters, which was followed by rigged presidential elections in January 2008, disgusting parliamentary elections and in May, and finally August war with Russia. I think that this is a chain of interdependent developments, but this issue is beyond the frames of this presentation. The reality is that after 2008, we enjoy growing authoritarianism and less modernization. Here I will stop describing present-day situation in Georgia. Several presentations from my colleagues focusing on various spheres are still to come tomorrow, but I will just add one point. Several years ago, the idea of creation of a regional financial center in Georgia failed straight away and is now forgotten. New dominating project is building touristic paradise in Georgia, in the situation where 45% of population officially employed in agriculture produce as little as 8% of GDP, and no goods for tourists shopping are produced in Georgia. This looks like an indication of an agony inside the ruling elite. They just don't know what should the priorities of the country be, what and how to develop. This is where the idea of transforming Georgia into Caucasus Singapore emerges from. But this is not the competitive financial and business market that attracts Saakashvili, most of all in Singapore model. This is Singaporean practice of maintaining power by one political force and one leader for decades. Once again, as in case of Gamsakhoudia, when approach independence first, democracy later prevailed, the dominating approach now is modernization first, democracy later. What is for sure, despite really unprecedented consolidated support, both domestic and international, whether political or financial, Saakashvili's rule is the period of lost opportunities. And if in the case of Saakashvili we observed president's fatigue, now we witness country's fatigue from her president. So what do we have now? 20 years since independence and 8 years after Rose Revolution, Georgia has become neither sustainable democracy nor sustainable economy. On the other hand, Georgia has become sustainable headache for the West and has gained sustainable enemy, Russia. Some conclusions of these 2 decades. Each of the 3 presidencies produced more or less successes, particularly in the first phase of the rule, followed by slowdown or even degeneration of initial plans. At the same time, each of the 3 presidents ruled on the background of different geopolitical realities and enjoyed different foreign aid and political support. All 3 won landslide victory in their first presidential elections, but Gamsakhoudia failed even to reach the next elections, being overthrown during the winter 91-92 Christmas coup. Shevardnadze's legitimacy dropped significantly when comparing 95 and 2000 presidential elections. Same is regarding Saakashvili with his official 96% in 2004 and 53% in 2008. I can argue that in their second elections, neither Shevardnadze nor Saakashvili won in the first round. In all 3 cases, we can note very high, I would say excessive, public expectations and proportionally fast public frustration leading to delegitimization of the president, which points to, I would say, infantilism of the voters. From this point of view, our infantile authorities are a reflection of infantile population. But here we also come to mystical interdependence between leaders' legitimacy and his performance, and may easily trace consistency, higher legitimacy, better performance, and vice versa. Neither of 3 Georgian presidents possessed clear vision of state they ought to build. Gamsakhoudia was bearer a mixed and controversial ideas of ethnic nationalism and common Caucasian house, self-isolation and closer relations with the West, convergence of socialism and capitalism. Shevardnadze knew that he had to build European-type state and even complied to some degree to the rules of the game, but he didn't know what exactly liberal democracy meant. This is why he looked so much out of date in the last phase of his presidency. Saakashvili, US-educated, pro-Western president, smartly convinced the rest of the world, and maybe himself as well, that liberal democracy was his sincere notion. But finding democratic procedures too boring, while freedom of others something too restricting his personal freedom, he quite easily changed his mind. And this is why his government tries not to adjust Georgia to the democratic procedures, but to adjust democratic procedures to their own rules, which means just the game with no rules. Let me remind you that the very first step of Saakashvili as a president was amendment of 95 Constitution, which resulted in abolition of checks and balances system and creation of excessively comfortable conditions for himself. And the latest amendments to the Georgian Constitution are generally viewed as an attempt to maintain power after second presidential term of Saakashvili expires in 2013. So the main lessons learned by political elite are as following. There is no need to develop and strengthen democracy. It's enough to talk a lot about democracy to be awarded a title of beacon of democracy. There is no need to stimulate pluralism. It's enough to create beloved opposition within the frames of party and the half political system. There is no need to care about freedom of speech. It's enough to strictly control all of all national TV channels and regret of polarized media space. and there is no need for accountability. Almighty Ministry of Interior, administrative resource, and TV propaganda are good enough for producing desirable outcome of the elections and self-legitimization. We live in dynamic world and rapidly changing geopolitical and internal realities. Even well-established and well-developed democracies face serious and growing challenges of such dynamism. And the very moment the signs of stagnation appear, it is clear indication that the time for changes has come. Each of three Georgian presidents exceeded his time limit. But Saakashvili still has a choice, whether he will be mainly remembered for modernization or for authoritarianism. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for inviting me. I think it's for me it's perfect place. It's not on?
It's on. It's on.
So what should I do then? There are some
closer.
Yeah, come closer.
Come closer, okay. For me Washington DC is a perfect place to somehow reminisce on the 20th anniversary of Georgia's independence.
Can everybody hear now?
No.
No. Okay. Let's.
Yeah. Now it's
okay.
So, too much? Yeah. I was saying that Washington DC is the best place for me to try to summarize this 20 years experience of 20 years because 20 years ago I was actually here in Washington, spending my fellowship in Cannon Institute and watching on CNN how Georgians were killing each other. And for that, I mean, it was the first time that Georgia was top news. I think from here, of course, it was very depressing to see it, to watch those developments, but also it's psychologically easier for me to, by remembering that time, to somehow imagine what Georgia had to achieve, as kind of imagining myself 20 years ago, and what it did achieve. Tom this morning said about calamities that we somehow countries in the Caucasus imposed over ourselves, but somehow I think Georgians were the best. We always compete with each other in the Caucasus, but when it comes to number of calamities and multiplicity of them, Georgia was the first and the best in having all of them, basically. And it was not coincidence then, maybe was not, but the moment of breaking up of the Soviet Union, which happened, end of December, coincided with the civil war in Georgia. So Georgia was failed state even before Soviet Union broke up. So it started as a disaster in all ways in which it was possible. So, of course, it makes maybe easier for me to declare how much we achieved, because as compared to that, we are obviously not a disaster now. But that's the reality. So I will start use that period as a starting point. But unlike Ivlian, I will not take this kind of historical period approach, but thematic approach, let's say. So I think we had kind of four arenas, four tasks to achieve. In order to become normal, I think for us, especially at that time, normalcy was the objective. So we had, I think, fourfold aim of nation building, state building, managing pluralism, and managing pluralism for me is synonymous to democracy and international positioning of our country to finding place in the international system. So nation building is about consolidating citizenship around the project of Georgia as institutions of Georgia as a state and creating loyalty and commitment to those institutions. And of course, we started again about wars around that. So there were some people like Abkhaz Ossetians who did not want to commit themselves to this project. But it was not only about them. There were then and sometimes later talks that Abkhazia Ossetia is just one range of problems. There are also Armenians and Azeris in relevant regions. Even Megrelians may be trouble, or Adjaria is a problem, etc., etc. So I think also by the sheer magnitude of those problems, and Georgia was probably at most risk in among the post-Soviet countries. So if we measure Georgia's success or failure in achieve 20 years ago, 20 years after, I would say it's a qualified success, more or less. It's not full success, of course, but it's qualified success. Of course, Abkhazia, not only the territory of Abkhazia, South Ossetia, but Abkhazians and Ossetians, those Ossetians who live in South Ossetia as communities, we failed to somehow involve them in Georgia's nation building and state building project, but that became quite more or less clear already in 1992-93 when the first wars ended. Even after that, we had the problem: what about Adjaria? What about Javakheti or Javakh, as Armenians call them? What about others? Georgia was always considered as a very fragile community as well. I think now we can say that we have at least some clarity about that, and I would say that the war of 2008, bad thing as it was, obviously was some kind of landmark. Now we have clarity that Abkhazian Ossetian issues are somehow suspended for indefinite time. So in a way, the conflicts themselves between Georgia and Abkhazia and Georgian society, Georgian state and Abkhazian community, or Georgian state and Ossetian community, were casualties of the war. But on the when it comes to others, I think Georgia is by and large a consolidated nation with problems, of course, problems of Georgian ethnic and ethno-religious nationalism. Of course, Armenian and Azeri-speaking communities are not really integrated, but still they are not viewed as major threatening challenges for the country. Now, when it comes to state building, as I said, we started it as a classical failed state in the end of 91, 92, 93. We were a textbook example of a failed state. After that, we had started to recover, but still, until the Rose Revolution, we were somehow weak state on the brink of failing state, let's say so, to use political science terms. I think in that area we have achieved the greatest success now, and of course that's a result of new government of the Rose Revolution, that now we are no longer failed or failing or weak state. Georgia has an efficacious functional state, which means not only on the side of control that it enforces monopoly on legitimate use of force, there are no free-running militias and warlords, but it also provides public goods. It's effective mechanism which provides really valuable public goods to its citizens and is appreciated as such. So does it mean that it's kind of 100%? And of course, I don't want to repeat this corruption, overcoming corruption, but it's very important because that Georgia has moved from late medieval style of state where public offices are basically bought and then the holders extracted resources from the people themselves to modern state where they work for salaries, actually. So I think the corruption as a structural problem have been really eradicated. And that's, of course, major achievement also by also obviously by regional standards, but also, I mean, not South Caucasus, but also beyond, in post-Soviet standards, surely. But is it 100% success? I would not say so, because the problem is that of sustainability. That success is based on effort of relatively small group of people who used somehow Jacobin methods somehow to achieve that. Yvelian already quoted me on terms of authoritarian modernization, which I really used in 2005 or 2006, but just to be precise, I said authoritarian modernization light. that was my term.
Which one was light? Modernization?
No, authoritarian modernization as a project, but not as a, in Ataturk it was kind of full, but here it was light. I meant to talk authoritarian component, yes. Now, managing pluralism, I mean, there are many different ways to define democracy, but especially in the Georgian context, I would stress this moment of managing pluralism because we had pluralism, but this pluralism meant that people were killing each other in the street and shelling each other from tanks. But it was pluralism. It was pluralistic in a way. So the public goods that democracy produces, why democracy is better than its alternatives, that it's the best at managing pluralism and channeling pluralism into peaceful competition between different groups. So obviously, what can we say about that? I think this is the area where we have the least success when it comes to specific specific assessment of successful Georgian governments, especially the last one. I guess my assessment is quite different from Ivlian's, or I assume also Shorena's, but I think we would all agree that Georgia is not full autocracy, but it's not accomplished democracy either. It's somewhere in between. It has very serious democracy deficit. The main problem, I would say, obvious problem, is that that legitimacy of the electoral process is very low, on the one hand, so that people don't believe that elections are the way to change government, and also that the level of polarization and confrontation is extremely high. In that sense, we can have, of course, have this kind of extremely pessimistic message, as Ivlian says, that it's infantile elite, infantile population, and that somehow keeps coming back. It's always the same. But I think that it's not the same. I think each government was actually better than the previous one. I don't know, and qualitatively better than previous one, and also that the public Georgian citizens became much less infantile and more mature as time passed by. So, as I would say, we did not learn how to change governments by elections, but we learned how to do revolutions. Our second revolution was much better than previous revolution. The previous one was bloody, second one was not. And actually now we may entering a new phase when we don't think that revolution is a good idea at all. I don't want to go into strictly political discussion, so I would say I'm quite skeptical about Ivlian's new political partner, Mr. Ivanishvili, but your party, sorry. I don't mean your personal part, life. yes. Certainly appreciate his clarity of his message when it comes that only peaceful and change of power is acceptable for Georgia and a new kind of violent confrontation would be a disaster. And it's, of course, it's his message, but it's also, I think, the lesson learned from this 20 years experience, which citizens drew, so it became less popular to have revolutions. But it's, of course, not enough. I think the key problem in Georgia is the absence so far of political party system, which is around some issues. I mean, Tom has in his book, on small book, booklet, whatever it's called, research on which post on display here on Georgia's choices. He has a mapping of Georgia's strategic choices. I cannot say I agree with those choices, but even if we assume that those are the choices, it would be very hard to demonstrate that Georgian political parties or have anything to do with those choices as depicted by Tom. So when I sometimes criticized, as in my NGO capacity, political parties, talk to them that why aren't you different? Why don't you have different programs, agendas? They say, some of them, of course, not in public, but in private, all of us have the same agenda. It's just that we differ, that, I mean, we dislike each other, so we just think that we will do that better. So most opposition parties in Georgia, including the Republicans, want to do the same as Misha, but better, I think, at least. So, and we are oscillating, as Tom Carothers would say, had said, I think he's coming tomorrow, between the poles of dominant power politics and feckless pluralism. And somehow we have more of dominant power politics now, or we have this feckless pluralism, and we play between one and the other. And the last is short, I understand I don't have too much time, on institutional positioning of our country. We had this concept of orphan nation. Nobody needs us. Even then, by the way, we spoke about, some of our leaders spoke about that we should join NATO and NATO will help us. It was in 1989. But at that time, it was considered something crazy, extravagant, dream of some not immature people, which it was probably. But one of the achievements of our 20 years is that we have clarity about this foreign policy orientation, which is shared by ostensibly by all major political actors. And also, so there is some point of national consensus around it, and this consensus implies, and it's understood widely, that this idea of European and Euro-Atlantic integration, both of them, this double integration, it's not only about security or patronage or support of the West, but it's about values, it's about a guideline for internal transformation of Georgia. It's also, and Hans, I said, said that in research shows that overwhelming majority of Georgians thinks that Georgia will be a democracy. So they may disagree whether we are democracy or whether we are or not democracy now, but we have almost full consensus that we will be a democracy, that there is this consensus that Georgia either becomes a European-style democracy or it just fails. It's just the Georgian project of Georgian nation will not be accomplished. So that's, I think, a good thing. And we also, I think, emerged or put behind this idea that we were just transit route, which was basically Shevardnadze's idea of westernization. Now I think we have clearer idea that westernization becomes means becoming a European democracy which actually contributes to international system and not just is a consumer of that. So it's also overcoming on infantile attitudes, which Julian mentions. And the last moment about the future, how we should overcome those deficits, and most important deficit is, of course, deficit of democracy. We have deficit of good relations with Russia, but unfortunately, I don't think we can do anything about it. It's maybe a price we pay for clarity of our foreign policy orientation. But what we need, I think, to work on in the nearest future, it's one, if what will help us to go to the next stage, it's development of political elite and capacity of political elite. I think we have had a very big big progress in that as compared with 20 years ago when really this our political discourse was completely immature. Now it's partly immature maybe sometimes, but still it's much better, although it's still not enough, neither for having not for having good government, so not enough good people, not enough mature, intelligent, and capable people to fool one good government, but even less success, enough, less sufficient for having reasonable government, but also good opposition. I think that has yet to be achieved. And also culture of accepting pluralism. I think that's what we really, political pluralism, I think cultural religious pluralism is also a problem, and we saw it this summer, but again, but accepting political pluralism in society, not just, I mean, between government and society or something, that's also a problem. I think we have these two images, conflicting images. On the one hand, the ruling party represents state, national interests, so everybody is, which is against, who is against government is against state. It's one image which is projected. And on the other hand, government, any government represents repression, so it's between government and the people. So pluralism is people as a people opposing government. And those are two discourses which makes actually democracy impossible. So the only discourse which makes democracy possible is of divided societies. That society is divided, that there are societal cleavages, that they are represented politically, and then there is some agreement between those sides. I think we don't have that discourse yet. We don't have that political culture yet, and we have to achieve that. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Okay, this is on. Thank you very much. Thanks to Carnegie Endowment and Mammon for having us here and for having me here. I feel very honored. And since the reports on Georgia don't get much better than what Tom writes about Georgia, I can just be a journalist and tell a story instead of sort of giving an academic presentation and bullet points of Georgia's recent history. But I'll have to start with a confession. I voted for the current government twice, first in 2004, like more than 90% of Georgians who wanted to end rampant corruption, which spread in all spheres of public and political life, and to bring democracy to the country through systemic reforms. And for the second time, I voted for this government in 2008, and that was pretty much the hardest choice that I had to make that I can remember of. That was right after the November 7 events, and that was when the government decided to forcefully and with excessive use of force to dismantle the wave of protests, as well as raided the offices of Imedi TV station and taking it off the air, allegedly for enticing anti-government riots. So going back to my votes, my first vote was an easy one. It was a clear battle between quote-unquote good and evil. We were all on the same sides of the barricades, strong, young, pro-Western opposition, strong civil society, a powerful independent national television station, and citizens fed up with Shevardnadze's weak and visionless government engulfed in corruption. So people who came to power with the Rose Revolution were our friends, young, ambitious, and as Gigi Ugulava, the current mayor of Tbilisi, once said, as liberal as it gets, and as liberal as we'll ever get. So we all rejoiced victory and went back to our lives, leaving the state building and democracy work to our friends who came to power with real ambitions to really go ahead with reforms, reforming the system and deliver promises. We woke up in 2007 with Okruashvili, Saakashvili's close ally and defense minister, famous for helicopter hunting and controversial war rhetoric, stepping down and accusing the government in a whole set of wrongdoings, including covering up the assassination of the former prime minister and Saakashvili's longtime friend, Zurab Zhuania. This started the first strong outrage after the Rose Revolution, fueled by the presence of the Georgian oligarch, Badri Patrakatsishvili, who is no longer alive. This was met by government's heavy hand and exposed its absolute intolerance of anyone trying to shake its political power base. The message was political opponents will be treated as enemies and will be dealt with by all means possible. Following the domestic and international outrage, Saakashvili announced early presidential elections in 2008. And again, we're back to my turning point, which is for me getting ready for the second vote. On the one hand, I was sort of making a list. On the one side, I was putting all the good things, and the good things were, for the first time after the breakup of the Soviet Union, we had electricity, gas, and water in most of the cities across Georgia. We had the overnight, almost overnight, reform of the law enforcement agencies and the police that no longer took any bribes. We had the reformed public office, where citizens could effectively get basic services like registering their property or getting a passport. We sure had better infrastructure and better roads, at least in some parts of the country, if not in the whole of Georgia. It's still a work in progress. We had various systemic reforms underway, though not without flaws, like the education system and the reform of the judiciary. And we had 12% economic growth in 2007 with Bendukidze's everything for sale, privatization, and tax cuts. Again, arguably the most successful economic policies. On the other hand, in the column of all the bad things, the list was a bit longer, and it looked more gruesome, but the government had consolidated its power in the executive branch, turning a one-party parliament into rubber-stamping all government-initiated laws and proposals, amending constitution many times in order to fit its immediate political goals, ignoring basic human rights with zero-tolerance policies and televised arrests, gaining almost total control over media and business sector. However, I thought mistakes were due to their youth and inexperience in governance, that perhaps they were so eager to quickly transform the country, with Russia looking down on us from the north, that they did not want to be slowed down by institutionalizing democracy and the elementary system of checks and balances. And I thought they still had the zeal to reform. No matter how unpopular these reforms were, it was just a matter of better communicating with the citizens and just overcoming the mistakes that they had made. So I decided, naively so, to give them a second chance, hoping that they had learned from their mistakes and having gained some ground, they would now make adjustments to the rules of the game. I also realized that even friends would not deliver democracy on a tray, and I gave myself a second chance of engaging in democracy work and not just leaving it to the government to do the job. However, with Saakashvili being provoked into opening fire on Tsikhinvali in 2008, and it was a provocation, my second vote became my biggest regret. With the turn of events, we had been on a downward spiral since, and Georgian democracy has never been so facade. The government spent all of remaining 2008 in trying to control the message about the war, and there are many anecdotes that I like to tell, but in interest of the time, maybe I should skip them, and I can come back to it later in the discussion session because I love these anecdotes. Invasion it was, but not without the help of our own government, which was mounting the war rhetoric 6 months before August in 2008, and for those skeptics who don't believe me, you can go back and watch some of the television debates which were on air, 6 to 8 months leading up to August events. Somehow the Georgian government thought that it would be a small-scale military operation, perhaps, and it would be as easy to regain control over Tsikhinvali as it was over Achara. Maybe that was part of their thinking, and maybe they relied too much on leniency of the Russians and outright support of the West. In any case, while with the Georgian opposition, which has been forever aligning and realigning among itself, not managing to become consistent policy-based opponents or successful at street protests, well, there are some objective reasons to this. The government went further in concentrating its power and executing literally a one-man show, with president determining even the cast of an opera or the details of an architectural project in Upper Svaneti. The national television media and 88% of Georgians still get their news from television. This is by CRRC surveys, is outright government propaganda with small variations on the public broadcaster. The government has achieved this by bringing TV stations under its indirect, offshore, or government loyal ownership, with editorial policy to all three stations being dictated by the state chancellery. And there have been some recent reports that show that. There is a document that is emailed every single day to the editors, to the producers of different news programs, and it's an identical piece of document which lists the content of the of each particular piece, with, you know, who the respondents should be, what should be the angle, what should be the context, what facts they should mention, etc., etc., etc. Despite the high demand, there is no investigative reporting or in-depth reporting on any national broadcasters. Maestro and Kavkasia, two local channels which cover Tbilisi, ensure the pluralism of opinions and have more fact-based reporting. However, due to controlled advertising streams, their capacity is incomparable to match the influence and reach of three national broadcasters. Two allegedly private national stations, Rustavi 2 and Imedi, also get 90% of all advertising revenues. This is accomplished due to crafty monopoly schemes operating on the media and advertising market, making the life of independent media outlets quite miserable and dependent solely on foreign donors. Our example could be a good one. Liberali would not be around if not for the generous support of Open Society Georgia Foundation and then Open Society Institute. In order to ease their life even more, last year the government issued a 36 million tax amnesty for television stations, out of which at least 25 million went to cover tax debts of Imedi and Rustavi. It's the same Imedi that shocked us with the modeled war, I don't know if you remember, a TV hoax aimed at keeping the Russian threat alive, and political opponents forever labeled as Russian agents. By the way, this Russian agent clause is very conveniently used every step of the way in dealing with the political opponents. That was the first thing mentioned, and that was the first question asked when Ivanishvili showed up, but he's really no exception. I mean, anybody who enters politics doesn't enter from the side of the government is very easily labeled as a Russian agent. He was not a Russian agent when he was generously funding a lot of the entrepreneurial or charity projects that the government was actually carrying out. Their independent print and online editions around, like Liberali or Batum Elebi or a couple of other regional media outlets which do engage in investigative reporting and are more critical and try to do fact-based reporting, but our content is accessed by potentially 5 to 6% of all country population which consume news via print or internet. Again, this is some numbers from the CRRC research. Furthermore, access to public information is a deteriorating trend. While we have a great administrative code, it is close to impossible to get any budget-related information from most of the government entities. For example, we don't know the volume of spending of the presidential fund. We also don't know how much, for example, the presidential palace cost us. And it's not a little building. It's a big building overlooking Tbilisi. And we're glad we have it, but we just know how much it cost us. Or why the Georgian National Lottery Company won the bid, which kicked out all players from the market and is an effective cash machine for the government and is run by managed by the former defense minister, Kazarashvili. Now, what this means is that with this media landscape, it will be close to impossible to win any elections for any incumbent. And I remember when I was asked, maybe a couple of months ago it was, by the USAID to name three policy recommendations that I would make for improving the media landscape. The first two I named had nothing to do with the media, and she was just quite surprised. The first I said, free the business environment. Well, this is wishful thinking, of course, but free the business environment and the market, and free the courts from the needs and dictates of the government. Because unless it makes sense to go to court, nobody is going to go to court. And there's a controversy about whether the trust in court is actually rising or not. And there's sort of throwing numbers back and forth. But essentially, I haven't heard of many business owners who have gone to court because they feel like they've, for example, they violated their rights, or teachers who've been fired, or the headmasters who've been fired. because of their political views or because they let some of their students go to protests. So again, not much trust in the courts. And the third recommendation I made was actually directly linked to the media, and that was that try to concentrate on your all, sort of all your efforts on liberalizing the public broadcaster, because that's really pretty much our only window into sort of the national media landscape and trying to sort of somehow change the media landscape. And as well as don't shy away from funding independent media and civil society. There are no serious problems with the media legislation or any other legislation, actually. It's a matter of execution. It's a matter of political will. So never mind the legislation, at least for the time being. Until all major businesses are government-controlled, whether it's sugar, petrol, lottery, gold mines, chocolate factories, banks, construction or distribution companies, kiosks, outdoor advertising agencies, and businesses which are not obedient are subject to selective tax punishment, it will not be possible to talk about sustainability of independent media or the sound opposition unless another oligarch comes to town. This is why it is frustrating to read articles in the international press about the libertarian Georgian government, which is an attractive PR package, I understand, since the whole world is giving up on sort of market fundamentalists. Here it is, a little country, Georgia, engaging in the experiment of libertarianism. But again, it's just words. It's just a package with the given market situation where there's literally no free market in the country. Also, unless business or citizens can seek justice in courts, we're living in a locked cycle with no prospects of developing pillars of democracy. Now, the status quo, until Bidzina Ivanishvili decided to enter politics, the status quo was quite boring and gruesome and bordering the state of complete stagnation. Growing anti-American sentiments because of growing unpopularity of Saakashvili, no prospects of opposition gaining significant representation in the government for the upcoming elections, and no resources for achieving any kind of breakthrough in this locked system. Again, the biggest topic of debate was whether Saakashvili would actually run for stay on as a prime minister, and that was basically the only thing that, you know, we could actually talk about. It's as if everything else was already a given. We'll see how even the appearance of Ivanishvili changes the landscape. I know you're also interested in it. It's definitely a good thing that he showed up, because it brought dead Georgian politics back to some life, and it has the potential to provide the very well-needed ammunition for the Georgian opposition. But if he becomes another one-man show, and if it really plays along well with the society's messiah sentiments, then we're in for another round of disappointments, and maybe for another cycle, for another 20-year cycle, which I hope will not be the case. But again, I hope the society really has matured, and hopefully we're a bit further than we were maybe 10 or 15 years ago. But lessons learned. Yes, I'm finishing. I'm always afraid of you, Ken. The only person I'm afraid of is you, being a strict moderator. Democracy, I think what's indisputable, and I think this is what we can all agree on, is that democracy is really our only comparative advantage in regional or international contexts. It's our way to the Western Alliance. It's our best security and domestic policy. It will not be delivered. This is another lesson we learned. It will not be delivered even by Western-educated young liberals unless there is a serious international push, as well as strong opposition, strong civil society, and the media domestically. That is why it is very important to support the process of democratization and keep this very high on the agenda. And unfortunately, if in 2004 the political elite was paramount to the country's progressive development, it has by now become its main impediment, precisely because of the shortcomings of democracy. And unless we're very honest about the shortcomings of this government, both international players as well as us living inside of Georgia, we're not going to be doing Georgia any good. So I hope we're very outright with our criticisms. Thank you.
I wanted to pick up on a couple of themes that have been mentioned here and maybe annoy you a little bit, but when I was ambassador in Georgia, one refrain that I heard continually is that, you know, if it weren't for U.S. support of Shevardnadze, everything would get better. You have to change the situation. Only you have the power to do that. Now we're hearing, you know, about blaming Russia for all of Georgia's ills. Of course, that happened earlier. And I'm going to pick up on something that Tom Duvall earlier said, you know, that it's now 20 years in. You know, Georgia, the South Caucasus countries are no longer young, you know, states in sort of transition. It's transformation now. And the question that I have is, when would an outsider expect, you know, that some of the ills of Georgia, you know, are looked at as problems for Georgians to solve and not for the international community to solve? And whoever wants to take that. Gia, please.
Yeah, I think blaming Russia and blaming U.S. or the West are two different kinds of blamings. Mm-hmm. I think that there is this perception in Georgian liberal elite that our people are somehow immature, so and there are no kind of structural preconditions for democracy, so people are not democratic, so democracy has to be delivered top-down. But if it should be delivered top-down, then how? I mean, it's historically, that's not how it happens, I think. So then some benign hegemon should force our political elite to behave democratically. And I think that did not change much from your ambassadorship to today. I think that's more or less a perception of Georgian liberal elite, let's say so. Whether it's, I think it's true more or less of the government and the opposition part of this liberal elite, but that people are undemocratic or people are illiberal. So democracy is an elite project. But because it's counterintuitive, that if, dominant elite be democratic, because by nature nobody likes to share power, so somebody else should be induced, and it cannot be come from below because people are immature, so then it should come from American embassy. What I think, and I think that's also immature, basically, but of course I think, but on the other hand, too, it's immature to overestimate that and to believe that somehow an American ambassador will say to president, you should behave, Misha or Eduard or whoever you are, and then he will behave. I think it will not happen like that. So it should come from political elite. I think historically, at least, I am maybe 20% activist, but 80% analyst, I would say. As I know from the history of democracies grow out of fights within elites, and somehow understanding that within elites that either they should go to civil war, which is impractical, or they should go to democracy, which is more practical. Or they try civil war first, as in Britain, for instance, and then they decided to have something like democracy. So we had already civil wars, so I think therefore, I am not, and unfortunately, I am a little bit skeptical about some new miracles that Misha will somehow fuel and Obama or whatever, or Hillary Clinton together will fool Misha, induce Misha to behave well. I don't expect that to happen. But I think that combination of different factors, which is, of course, Georgian political elites, sincere ambition that we are European, we are Western, we should behave within certain limits, but also a greater maturity of civil society opposition. All this together will move us towards more pluralism rather than less pluralism.
Brief comment. I do agree with you that the democracy it's a bottom-up exercise for sure. But from my experience, my other hat is being an activist and being involved in some of the advocacy work, the media advocacy work. And the cases where we have been successful, it was only the cases when the international community got engaged or somehow work together with us on really putting the issue on the agenda. Unless, unfortunately, this has been our experience that over the past 2 or 3 years, unless there is a international attention on an issue, the Georgian government really doesn't react much. It's very hard to engage them. It's a good thing that they're so sensitive to international pressure. That's why I keep reiterating that in order for us to really accomplish something through advocacy and through the democracy mechanisms that are old in the States but are very new to Georgia, it's when the domestic and the international community work together. And we've had cases with the public broadcaster, we've had cases with any number of issues, including the tax amnesty law, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So unfortunately, it is a reality that if we want for our government to react, we need to have Americans watching the issue.
Yes, thank you.
This is very topical question, in fact. Regarding American attitude towards Georgia, you see, it really looked and looks in Georgia quite personalized. And the aid and assistance was and still is accepted as a personal assistance to Shevardnadze and now personal assistance to Saakashvili. And it was not very true under Shevardnadze. But if we analyze the years 2004-2008, this is first presidency of Shevardnadze, which coincided with the previous administration in the United States, we did not hear in Georgia a single word of critics of Saakashvili. A single loud voice, word of critics of Saakashvili. And I will give you an example. 2007 November events. According to official data, about 600 protesters were injured, poisoned, beaten, I don't know, and so on. And no reaction from official Washington. That same day, a protest rally was held in Moscow under Garry Kasparov's leadership, and 300 people participated in this rally. And about 30 of them were arrested, and 5 of them were imprisoned for, 3 days or 5 days. And there was a special United States Department of State
statement.
Reaction, you see. And this is why I am so concerned about rise of anti-American feelings in Georgia. Because it was not the case under Shevardnadze. It was not a case at all under the Shevardnadze. And under Saakashvili, we do have this demonstration and declaration of anti-American feelings. They are not too numerous and, the country looks towards the West, Euro-Atlantic integration, and there is understanding that if not West, and the United States in particular, Georgia may have not existed these 20 years, you see. But still, we can talk about the factor of anti-Americanism in Georgia. And this is a point of concern. Regarding Russian case, you see, this is absolutely different case. But again, we have to take into consideration that Saakashvili made anti Kremlinism or anti-Putinism a cornerstone of his policy, not only international, but even domestic. And Chorena covered, actually, this issue. Opposition activates, and the leaders of opposition are declared Kremlin's or Moscow's agents. And these are Bujanadze, who was the second, for 4 years, she was the second person in the hierarchy after Saakashvili. This is Nogaideli, who was the prime minister for 2.5 years. This is Okurashvili, who was the favorite minister of defense. What's happening, you see? What's happening? And then Patakatsishvili, Ivanishvili, automatically, you see. If you listen to Saakashvili, there is no Georgian-Abkhaz conflict at all. There is Georgian-Russian conflict. As if Russians withdraw tomorrow, the Georgian-Abkhaz conflict will evaporate. It will not evaporate. It is on the table, you see. And this simplification, you see, this leads to another thing, you see. After the 2008 August war, we witness strengthening of pro-Russian feelings in Georgia, because people are fed, you see, when everything, whatever bad happens to Georgia, whether internally or internationally, oh, that's Russia. That's Kremlin, that's Putin, that's GRU, and so on. No, we have, and this is, by the way, a response to your question. We have a lot of problems which we Georgians have to decide, you see, and find solutions. And from certain point of view, what we lack most of all, this is Georgian-Georgian dialogue. Mm-hmm. Georgian-Georgian dialogue. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, let's go to questions. Again, please stand and wait for a microphone. Let's start down here.
My name's Alex Van Oss. I work at the Foreign Service Institute. I wanted to ask a question about fun. Fun, F-U-N, on the Black Sea. Yesterday I read a rather interesting article in a trendy magazine about Batumi, all the building. This is Saakashvili's dream, the lights, the action, the many five-star hotels that I can't afford to stay in. I'm intrigued because I'm curious if you think this is going to be a disaster or if you think that this is a big idea that has some potential to start the economy, restart agriculture, feed the tourists if they come. Let's talk about fun a little bit.
Can I start talking
about
fun?
Yeah, go ahead. You start the fun, Shorina, please.
There could be potential for tourism, but I think with the Turkey next door, with four seas and beautiful resorts, I think our, again, using the word comparative advantage is not building five-star hotels at the Black Sea. By the way, Black Sea is not a very good sea to swim in. I mean, I go there from time to time and, you know, it's, besides the environmental hazards of just, you know, oil pouring into it and just, you know, they're very rare shores where you can actually go and have fun. The point is that I think Georgia does have tourist potential, but not in the way that, not in the five-star Black Sea resort type of way. Maybe there is more potential for cultural tourism. Maybe there is more potential for wilderness. Now, that's one thing said. Another thing is how that translates into sort of a bigger economic sort of income for Georgia. Again, it doesn't seem to translate at this point in time because, again, we import 95% of our sort of our agricultural products, which is such a shame because we are an agricultural country and basically we've become a dumping market for the Turkish goods. What this means is that all the income that we get from tourism, we actually have to, you know, pay it in export. So it's actually operating upside down at this point in time. So I don't know. It would be great if it's not a, you know, Saakashvili chimera of, you know, turning Georgia into a tourist haven. But again, it does not seem possible to turn it into the type of haven that Saakashvili wants to turn it into. I think there is, you know, I think we should aim for a different type of tourism if we are, but we should definitely concentrate more on sort of encouraging the local production of agricultural goods and farming.
Okay, no multi-billion-dollar ski resorts like in the North Caucasus then.
Yeah.
Yes, Clay, please.
Thank you very much, Chairman. Craig Oliphant, until recently in the British Foreign Office. I wondered if I could ask two short questions, really, to all the panel. And Ivliani mentioned the need, actually, for a Georgian-Georgian dialogue. But I wondered if, looking at the period in question, whether the panelists could just comment on how they view the evolution of the treatment of minorities in Georgia, glass half empty, glass half full, or what directions there. And I suppose related to that, the question, and thinking back to Hans Goodbrot's presentation earlier this morning, church and politics, what would be your assessment of the role and place of the patriarch, and also the resonance of his input now as we look ahead? Thank you.
I will answer those questions, but I wanted also, because, I don't know, our positions, I think, differ also on some facts as well as opinions with regards to many things. I think it's important thing, especially while we are in the United States, to talk about this so-called alleged anti-Americanism spreading in Georgia. As far as I know, there are no surveys, but there are public opinion surveys, but none of them show any spread of anti-Americanism, and I don't think that this can be explained somehow. People are afraid of expressing anti-Americanism. So I think there are some changes in the sense that within political elite, if earlier nobody was protesting about America, now there are some people going to American embassy, some parties, and blaming America for Saakashvili or something like that. But I think it still would be much stretching, you know, the reality saying that there is a spread of anti-Americanism. But also, I think it's not necessarily that because Saakashvili is seen as American project, and because of that, that leads to something. But it's also, I think, anti-Americanism is everywhere. So because government is really kind of, in a sense, Americanizing things or whatever, so protest against this policy, not just against Saakashvili personally, is expressed as anti-Americanism. And this leads actually to that question which Craig answered, in terms of policy, in terms of strategic choice or whatever policies, it's hard to say what is the alternative to Saakashvili, because I think that these liberal critics of Saakashvili, which I think are represented here, I think they are still kind of Misha, but better direction represent, but it's this direction, but this is, does not resonate with much, too many of the Georgian public. But there is also another direction of rejecting this government, which is nativist, or how to call it, people who think that this government is undermining Georgianness of Georgia, something like that. And they have a church as its flag. It's one thing that the church itself is not uniform in its views. Patriarch himself is sort of balancing politician, a little bit like Shevardnadze, I would say, in his temperament. But within church, there are lots of preachers who use pulpit to aggressively denounce government. And one of the topics is that they treat minorities well, or they treat minorities too well. And so that president is really Armenian, so he's hidden Armenian who kind of has Armenian agenda. Becomes a political problem also, not only for the government, of course, it's a problem for the government, but in general, I think I don't think that that's, there is political strategy behind it, but it's still some kind of alternative discourse, let's say so. Political parties of the opposition, of course, some of they are different from each other, but sometimes they try to capitalize on that discourse and directly or indirectly. So that's part of the problem. So we, I mean, it's also nothing unique. I mean, there is so-called extreme right in every country, maybe not so much in this, but certainly in any European country. But in Georgian case, I think the difference from Gamsakhurdia's time when we had ethnic nationalism, now we have religious nationalism, which is openly anti-Western. In that discourse, America is bad. America is bad because it's liberal, because it likes homosexuals, because it forces us to treat Armenians as equals to ethnic Georgians. And that's why America is bad. So, and that you read in some part of opposition media, etc. So that is a problem. So government tries to play double game to, I would say, bribe church on the one hand, subsidize them, buy them four-wheel drive cars, somehow try to appease them. But this summer, things came to a head when government adopted some new legislation which allowed for registering all minority churches as entities of private law, which they demand, which they had been demanding for years. And the church was against that. That issue was there and had been discussed somehow, not so publicly, but among stakeholders, as they saw. But the government, because it's what was very unpopular to do anything against church, did not dare doing something. But maybe now they thought that it's July, it's hot, elections are next August, next October, so we can dare to do it. And it was quite a dangerous moment because there were some rallies and it seemed so that this church was our, not just only church, but some radical priests, but also some political radicals who allied with them were going to mobilize really huge campaign against government on that particular issue. But then government managed to find some common ground with the church leadership. I think it's also, in that sense, Byzantine traditions help, because Orthodox Church has a tradition to somehow have good relations with government. So it's, but that's also linked to Russia issue. I mean, I also disagree with the fact that any opposition party is portrayed as a kind of Russian party. But I think there is, of course, sometimes mistreatment of this motive by the government, but it's also, I think, true that Russian government has not reconciled itself to failing to change government after the 2008 war, and it hoped, I think, that after Georgia lost the war, the Georgian people would get rid of Misha themselves, but it failed. So I think this church is seen as by many people as Russia's partner, basically, because many people in the hierarchy, church hierarchy, they studied in Russia, and their mentality is anti-Western, hence pro-Russian. So this creates this kind of geopolitical, or how to say it, of geospiritual dimension to relations between church and state.
Thank you. Wow.
Actually, I fully agree with this vision. This is a rare situation when me and Gia fully agree on the issue, but this is the case. But I just wanted to add a couple of words. Church and the patriarch, they have very high rating of trust, but there is interdependence between rating of authorities, civil authorities, and the church. The higher is the higher is the trust in the civil authorities, the lower is trust in the churches. This is something like that. And there are very data. And the year 2006, when, from my point of view, Saakashvili was on his peak, the church and the patriarch had relatively lower trust in the society, still very high. But you see, this is, from certain point of view, sorry, but I will compare situation with Azerbaijan. You see, if you marginalize political opposition and you leave free space, you see, this will be Islamists who will occupy this space. And the same case is in Georgia. If you marginalize opposition, and especially if you marginalize democratic opposition, somebody has to occupy this space. And the church in this case becomes stronger and it occupies this vacant position. But I would not overestimate the danger of orthodoxy in Georgia. Yep. I would not, because, well, Georgian are orthodox atheists from my point of view. Thank you.
I'm going to start bundling questions because we got lots of hands up. Wayne, you had your hand up, and Mark, if you do, and in fact, yeah, go. Let's get the three questions here, too.
Wayne, Mary, I'm interested in some of the anecdotes that were promised.
Mark?
Thanks. Mark Mullen. When I was with NDI from Tbilisi from 97 to 2003, you know, I was shooting my mouth off on TV all the time about whatever I felt like. Yep. Now, soon after the revolution, we were reined in pretty tight. I mean, in terms of meetings with government and media, and that lasted, I think, for for a while. Now, up until really pretty recently, I'd say a couple of years ago, there were very few public statements from critical of the government, and I think that's changed a little bit. That now that the embassy, for instance, the most recent human rights report had a YouTube video where the ambassador was speaking in English but with Georgian subtitles, saying what it said, so that the embassy did the translation rather than leaving that to a Georgian government press release, which I think was quite important. However, I know from USAID grantees in Tbilisi that there is still an almost complete ban on them speaking to the media, which is unfortunate because they've been watching the election law negotiations and everything else. Now, my question, especially my first question to Gia and Ivliana, is that noticeable, the absence of sort of semi-quasi-official Americans, USAID grantees, speaking, so that there's some distance with the embassy? My second question to Shorena is about Kanal Pik, which, for those of you who don't know, is a Georgian government-funded Russian-language television station. I know from in terms of the region and potential regional catalysts to any change, I know from the head of that station that the government of Azerbaijan is extremely nervous about that. It's largely on the internet and through international satellites, and there's not really particularly good numbers, but there's the government of Azerbaijan watches it quite closely. I don't know if the Armenian government does, but I've been surprised that there doesn't seem to be official U.S. interest in funding it through some sort of foundation or something like that, so that it's not, there's a worry now that the leadership is changing, that it might become just sort of a government mouthpiece and not particularly interesting. It's already spends a lot of time on Misha's travel schedule and how horrible Russia is, and you know, that might continue. And so what I'm wondering is, if it were a partially Georgian government-funded Russian language media presence, could that potentially positively influence the quality of domestic media in Armenia and Azerbaijan?
All right. And please, and then, yeah. I'm asking, too, please keep the questions a little shorter because we're really starting to run out of time.
Toby Davis, U.S. Department of State Research Bureau. Thank you very much for your presentations. I'd like all the panelists to give me your worst case scenario and best case scenario of the electoral process from now until the October 2012 elections and where you think the ruling party will come down in the middle of that. Thank you.
Very good questions. Who wants to go first?
Shall I try?
Go ahead, Shorty, please.
The worst case scenario will be that Ivanishvili will not be allowed to enter the contest. We still don't know what his precise sort of political goals are. We don't know whether he's going to run himself or whether he's going to create a sort of a, some kind of a political movement, whether he's going to create a party. It's still very much an amorphous process. The people who are already working closely with him, they too don't know exactly how it will shape up in the end. But if for some reason his political party or movement or in any shape or form enters the political contest but is not allowed for any number of reasons, because of the citizenship issues or because of some other issues, I think this really can sort of ignite the process that we none of us wants to see, which is... Again, you know, taking politics back to the street and, you know, sort of going back down the unpredictable roads that we've gone down to. So hopefully that will not happen. Unfortunately, the signs that the government's handling of Ivanishvili's appearance are very unfortunate. Just they didn't register his movement. The public registry did not register his movement for 3 weeks, and finally they did. I just read it on the news today. Finally, it's registered. They had absolutely no reason not to register it, but they, you know, they still sort of gave it as an obstacle. Again, they introduced a whole set of laws that are just being drafted. A couple of them are already drafted, and I think one of them is now already at the Venice Commission, waiting for the approval. It's about the campaign finance and the limits of funding to the finance. So they're already framing the political process. Again, if there are too many limitations, if there are too many, you know, if there is too much hysteria from the government, which somehow discourages the fair play or does not leave much room for fair play, again, we can be facing a worst-case scenario. Now, the best-case scenario is that there is elections, there is real competition, we're having some kind of a bipolar sort of competition where there is some kind of a middle ground where all this contest can actually play out. I was wondering where it can actually happen, on what TV station, because again, for Tbilisi, the case is easier because there is, you know, sort of more open, there are more open platforms, media platforms, for this contest to take place. But we don't know what's going to happen outside of Tbilisi. I mean, will any national television station allow and reflect the political processes that will be going on? Oh, we don't know. So the good scenario is that there is a competition, and then we're going down to the elections, and then, you know, the Georgian public decides whom they're going to vote for. I think that could be the best thing that that we can see in the next 2 years.
Serena, any
anecdotes? Oh, anecdotes. The anecdotes.
Also,
was
any comments on Mark's question?
The Mark's question. Mark, it's an interesting idea of whether P can be co-funded by sort of the USAID plus the Georgian Public Broadcaster's money. But to give you a little bit of background, I was also on the board of the Georgian Public Broadcaster, and out of the blue, the idea of starting PEAK, a third service to the Georgian public broadcaster, appeared. It was clearly Misha's idea, and it was Misha's idea for Robert Parsons, who is a sort of a former BBC France Press journalist, fluent in Georgian, to actually run it. So they basically went through a very sort of quick process of outsourcing the third channel, hiring, you know, Robert Parson, who is a good friend, and absolutely nothing against him, but the process itself was absolutely shady. It was, you know, done with violations of, you know, all possible procedures. it was not clear why we were starting it, what was the feasibility study, why we should spend almost 40 million laris on a third service, which is actually broadcasting to the Russian audience, while the Georgian broadcaster keeps complaining about not having enough funds for starting investigative reporting for the Georgian audience, for example, or just not having enough funds to carry some of the reforms and diversify some of its airtime or starting political talk shows. So what was this? What was the idea? But once it was started, and now that we've spent so much money on it, it would be a shame for it to go back to the, you know, being just like Alania, which was this, you know, local Russian shady tabloid political media platform. So I think it's it could be a good opportunity to actually save PEEK from the claws, for it to be becoming another government-controlled enterprise or another government-controlled project. So maybe if there is oversight, if it's brought back to some kind of an oversight, and if there is some kind of sort of transparent funding provided to it, and there's sort of the will to save it, yeah, maybe that could be a good idea now that it's up and running. Because what we are seeing is that it's going back to Gaheladze control, which is not a good sign. Sorry for the internal. And the quick anecdote, just not that big of a deal. It was just a quick one. Just after the war in 2008, a couple of journalists, including the Economist journalist and a Financial Times journalist, they were in town covering the post-war Georgia, and we're sitting on top of, I don't know if maybe some of you have been there, Coppola, which is a restaurant in Tbilisi. And we're sitting there, and of course it's a conversation, I mean, it's a dinner turning into a conversation or an interview, and so we're talking about the war, and of course, we're saying that, you know, there's also, you know, we're talking about the question of accountability of the Georgian government. All of a sudden, it's 11 at night, Giga Bokeria, who was then the deputy foreign minister and is now the head of the Security Council, shows up, and he says, well, I'm here waiting for my wife. We're having dinner here. And then we pretty much stayed there until 1 o'clock in the morning, but nobody showed up. So we're like, oh, that's strange. She stood him up. But then we went to a different place, and he came along. And the funny thing is that I would never imagine that he would actually go around spying on the foreign. He himself would go around spying on the foreign journalists. But then we had a conversation about this, and he actually said that he was there, just basically controlling the message and trying to intimidate us with his presence. That shows some of the paranoia and some of the sort of very physical paranoia sometimes of at what extent they go to control the message.
All right, we just have a few minutes left. I want to leave time for questions for our guests from Azerbaijan, Armenia, and also anyone else from Georgia. But please hear. And then
my question is also related to Georgian experience, which I find very much similar in many respects from historical perspective. And in fact, the stages that Ivlian mentioned, chaos, stability and stagnation, and then authoritarian modernism, can be perfectly applicable to Azerbaijani context as well.
Feel free to pay.
It was almost coinciding with my presentation and the stages that I set up. But there is also another thing, opposition as a factor, and it was mentioned by Guy and Shorena that strong opposition, there has to be strong push from the opposition itself so that democracy would flourish in Georgia. And we've heard, in my presentation I mentioned that in Azerbaijan, opposition is no longer a force to reckon with, and the domestic developments are shaped based on the inner infighting or struggles within the ruling elite itself. And it was exactly the same argument was used in Armenia panel. And our Armenian colleagues also mentioned that now increasingly the domestic developments in Armenia are shaped by within the inner circle. So I wonder, do you see a threat in Georgia of having an opposition increasingly becoming irrelevant as an actor shaping the political developments, domestic political developments, particularly in the light of the fact that apparently there are no although many people are dissatisfied with Saakashvili, and now he increasingly reminds Ilham Aliyev in a sense that although many people may be dissatisfied with the situation in Georgia, but he is the best worst politician that Georgians have at the moment, and all other politicians around are not popular enough, and people do not feel really confident enough to support them. Like you mentioned, Ivlian, this group of people like Burjanadze, Nogaidele, Okrashvili. I mean, how? And they try to use this Russian card, and they try to position themselves as people who can garner support of the population in Georgia, who is more supportive of better relations with Russia. But I mean, how realistic can they actually represent the interests of the Georgian population as a whole? Even Alassania, unfortunately, how much do you see a potential for him to become a leader? So I'm just lost at looking at the Georgian political space. Do you see anyone in that position who can actually be a credible force to Saakashvili, even in spite of the fact that many people are unhappy with Saakashvili, but at the end, there is no other alternative, you see?
Great, thank you. Good question. Who wants to answer?
What we have now, this is the result of the process, and I mentioned the process of marginalization of opposition in Georgia, you see. And Shorena mentioned that opposition actually was deprived possibility of existence, especially from financial point of view, but from point of view of media elsewhere, you see. So they did not have the space. From this point of view, and this will be my response to Toby's question as well, what is the worst case scenario in Georgia as a result of the coming elections? From my point of view, this is a kind of legalization and institutionalization of authoritarianism through these coming elections. This is the worst case scenario. The best case scenario is United National Movement, I mean this ruling organization, transforming into political party and moving either into opposition or into the ruling coalition. Thank you.
Yeah, also several questions. I think I was not asked about it, but I would agree with Mark also that it would be a good idea if PIK becomes some kind of joint venture of Georgian government and somebody else. And but as to American organizations, USAID grantees playing a more active role, frankly, I don't think that that's important in terms of Georgian, internal Georgian political process. It was important before. I don't see it anyway.
I'm a USAID grantee as well.
I don't think that you are not outspoken enough. I think I don't think that's a real problem. I think that Mark mentioned American grantees of USAID who are, for some reasons, not speaking publicly.
Okay.
That's how I understood the question. As to best and worst case scenario, I think theoretically we can agree that with Shorena, for instance, that it's best case if there is democracy and open competition, worst case if it's not competition and people go to the streets. But frankly, I don't, if we pick about not theoretical scenarios, but likely scenarios, I don't see any either kind of catastrophic scenario happening, or I don't also see what is best case scenario in Ivlian's view. Of course, he's a political actor himself, and he has his own preferences, but I don't see that happening as well. In terms of electoral outcome, I think, again, not being very hopeful of Mr. Ivanishvili, that if somehow his advent leads to UNM not gaining constitutional majority in parliament, that would be excellent outcome. Good for Georgia, because I don't think that having one party with constitutional majority is a good idea. But there was some, also that hope that within Georgian inner, within UNM, as in Armenian case, it was said that there is some political process within ruling circle. Sometimes opposition has, I think, wishful thinking about that, or had before Ivanishvili came, that there are some factions within UNM fighting each other. I don't see it happening in United Nations movement. But as to problem that opposition is failing to pose a credible challenge to government, unfortunately that's true. But then it's I think it's too much depends on political preferences to say that it's government's fault somehow, which forces opposition to make wrong things, and then they discredit themselves because they are put in some under some pressure. But for instance, why Alassane lost his credibility? I think because he showed that he's not a good leader and he was very inconsistent, and although his initial rating were quite high within the same system basically, but then he went down. So unfortunately, that's the case, but I understand it's very, very political. This very political difference of opinion.
Can I ask you one quick question? How many permanent staff members do you think the Republican Party has? This is a question that Hans Gutbord asked me today. I would have never guessed. Permanent staff of the Republican Party,
no
which
idea.
Is the oldest party in.
Oldest does not mean.
Well, old, yeah, of course, but apparently they have 5 permanent staff members across Georgia. This does not include the leaders, of course. I don't know how much you can do with that capacity.
Right. Anyway. One last question from a visitor. Are we finished? Is there one last question way in the back, and this will do it.
Hi, Elmar Shakhtakhtinsky with Azerbaijani Americans for Democracy. I mean, just a quick comment. I wouldn't compare Georgian situation to Azerbaijan, and that relates to my question. Azerbaijan is pretty much in that medieval stage that Gia described, I think, in terms of corruption. And my question is, is the gains that I think all presenters from Georgia agreed on, at least there is one notable gain, and that's eliminating structural corruption in civil service and law enforcement. And how reversible is it in terms of how deep it took roots in society? Can Georgia quickly go back into corruption as a way of life, as in Azerbaijan, for example, or Central Asia? That's just my question. Thanks.
Nothing is irreversible. I think there is a physics second law of thermodynamics or something, which is the sole law which describes irreversible processes. All other processes in nature are reversible. But I think that, while of course it is not irreversible, but creation, a precedent of fairly clean civil and efficient civil service in Georgia is in itself very important, because I remember when I was in Shevardnadze's time, member of commission developing anti-corruption strategy, something many people thought that very cynical. I mean, yes, it's good that you are in the commission, but we all understand that Georgia will always be corrupt. I mean, it's just Georgian character. We should be corrupt. I mean, it's just very naive to even dream about it, that Georgia is not, that Georgia, the traffic policemen not taking bribes. It's against the nature of Georgia. And now that stereotype is broken. So that does not mean it's irreversible, but it will be difficult to reverse for any new politician, because people will remember that even in Georgia it's possible that we have non-corrupt traffic police, or I mean now it's not called traffic police, whatever.
I will add a couple of words. It's too early to congratulate each other with the victory over systemic corruption, because elite corruption is something absolutely acknowledged in Georgia, and everybody knows that.
I should supply you with our magazines.
Yes, this is something that unfortunately remains in Georgia, and to a certain degree, to certain the shapes political and economic life in the country. But, and I stressed it in my presentation, the reform, administrative reform, the reform of bureaucracy, with which I am proud of, because Georgian bureaucracy is neither Soviet nor post-Soviet bureaucracy. This is different bureaucracy, which has nothing to do with Soviet type of bureaucracy. So as one of the main achievements of 2 decades of independent Georgia, I am almost sure that we will manage to maintain this achievement in any case. Thank you.
Thank you again, everyone.
Thanks, everyone. I'm delighted to see there are actually more people at the end of the day than there were at the beginning, which is obviously a good sign. We look forward to seeing a lot of you back here tomorrow for more lively discussion. And for conference visitors, please come back for dinner, which will be in about an hour's time, just before 7 o'clock. We'll be having dinner downstairs where we started this morning. But thank you again, everyone.